welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. Today I'm joined by Shai Tubali. I love this conversation. Shai is an international speaker, author, and spiritual teacher. He's a leading authority in the field of self-development and chakras and the subtle body, and he's published 12 books. He serves as the academic researcher at the University of Leeds, and he's developed several meditation-based therapeutic methods. So today we're going to talk about being limitless. So we'll get right into the nature of transformation and how we can see the transformational process as alchemical. So what are the ingredients needed to spark that alchemy? We'll talk about what the chakra system brings. And for me, this is a real eye-opener. As a meditator, Shai has some thoughts about how many people actually have an imbalance to their process, to their approach, and what can result as a consequence of that. I also want to point out that we'll be releasing a part two on his powerful approach called the expansion method. Let's dive in. Here is the podcast with Shai Tubali. Before we get into today's podcast, I've got an invitation for you. We're about to kick off the sixth edition of our most popular program, The Neuroscience of Change. This training is based on what revolutionary research in neuroscience has revealed about transformational coaching, essentially showing us what works, what doesn't, and why. In the program, you'll learn what happens in the brain and body when different coaching techniques are used, how to guide your clients into positive learning states that allow genuine change to occur, and why some tried and true coaching methods actually inhibit change and what we can do instead. We created this course because I learned things from the lead teacher, Amanda Blake, that truly revolutionized the way I coach. And every year, she and all the teachers bring in new, cutting-edge science that continues to illuminate the process of transformation. Amanda will be joined by the rest of our world-class faculty of coaches and neuroscientists for this program, including Dan Siegel, Alan Fogel, Claire Dale, David Trelevin, and Richard Boyatzis. It's going to be an amazing, transformative journey, so I hope you'll come and join us. You can head to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. The first class is February 25th, 2025 with Amanda Blake. And if you sign up by February the 7th, you can get the early bird discount. So just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. Shai, it's wonderful to be with you today. I'm really excited about our conversation. How are you, first of all?
I'm doing very well, and I feel very honored to be a part of your profound podcast. Exceptionally profound podcast.
Thank you. No pressure on our conversation today. I have a feeling this will be a profound conversation, actually. So, yeah, I actually wanted to begin by asking you if you could introduce yourself to the listeners. What would you say to them about who you are and what you're up to in the world?
That's a good starting point. Well, I would say that I'm a sort of strange hybrid, a combination of. Say that I'm a researcher of consciousness. That's my interest. That's my passion in life. The potential of human consciousness, the transformative potential of consciousness. But I do that, I approach that from two seemingly contrasting angles. The first is academic. I'm a researcher in philosophy. Right now, a research fellow at the University of Leeds. And what I do from the academic philosophy angle is examine the potential of consciousness from the objective point of view, which means that we take a look, we step back and we look at consciousness and try to understand this phenomena intellectually, but then we know that we cannot grasp it fully intellectually. We have to somehow crawl into our own consciousness, tap into it, and discover it from within. So we have to have this kind of experiential dimension, and that is my different and perhaps predominant angle, which is that of a mystic. What I do and what I've actually done since the age of 21, now I'm 47, is dedicate my life to this kind of exploration, the true nature of consciousness and what it can do for us as human beings, because we are also strange hybrids of consciousness, spirit, limitlessness, Buddha nature, if you will, and flesh and blood and mortal and extremely limited human being. So this is what I do, this kind of meeting point between the academic and the mystic, the mystical in the realm of consciousness.
We're going to focus the vast majority of our conversation on, you know, on the mystical, experiential side of consciousness and transformational work, but
the fun part.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm just curious because, you know, the from an academic perspective, it's an interesting exploration, isn't it? Because of the hard problem of consciousness and materialistic science and. Yeah, what's my question here? It's like where do you feel like we're at in that field, you know? I know there's a lot of different viewpoints and arguments taking place. That's a big question, but just to touch into it. Yeah.
Yes, well, I approach the question of consciousness from the point of view, the more, let's say, liberated for point of view, a soteriological point of view, that of liberation, which means that it naturally embraces the approach that is non-physicalist, which means that the assumption fulfilled through our own direct experience is that consciousness is something that imbues and saturates the entire universe, that is the universe, that is the all container of all and everything, and that is therefore a transcendent view enabled to us as human beings. This is the spark of the spirit in us. So this is, of course, very different from, I would say, because in the field of philosophy, most philosophers nowadays are bent toward scientific views and therefore physicalist views. And the way they approach this is, I would summarize it in one sentence. We have no ability to establish that because there is a problem. Consciousness is a problem that we cannot tackle or grapple with currently, but we are sure that the physicalist view is the correct one. So that's right now the predominant paradigm, and this is how they resolve it nowadays.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's a whole rabbit hole we could go down with that. And I, in the end, you know, I think for me, like, we could say like the mystics and, you know, some of this wisdom traditions are perhaps the real scientists of consciousness, as they've, you know, explored experientially these expanded places we can go to. So let's go there now. Yeah, I actually wanted to ask you. I know your work is very broad and deep, and so there's many places we could go to today. We're going to talk about the expansion method predominantly, I think. But something that I read on your site, which talked about how you make use of ancient mystical knowledge to enlighten our human experience.
Yes.
And you said that transcendent states of consciousness have the power to pour meaning, depth, order, and clarity into our deeply complex and sometimes troubled life. And then this line here, in my work, I aim to clarify the principle of psychological and spiritual transformation as much as possible. Mm. I just wondered if you could speak about that principle or the principles of psychological and spiritual transformation? Like, yeah, is there a kind of general principle or unifying principle you found in that work, knowing there's many facets to it?
Well, that's a question of a lifetime, I would say. That's exactly what I do. But just perhaps to point out several revelations associated with that statement. Well, first of all, we need to understand what transformation is, you see, because nowadays everyone uses this term in so many different connotations, and I think it's widely and also cheaply used. So the term transformation for me is very sacred, and actually it needs to be distinguished from what we should refer to as change or self improvement. Because transformation means that there is one thing, and that it all together changes its form, changes its nature. So it's a radical kind of alteration. Now, what is the most radical type of alteration that the humans can actually engage with? It is dealing not with what our content, the contents of our consciousness, what, I don't know, thoughts, improving or correcting a certain pattern that I have. For instance, I don't know, a certain food addiction. So let's say I work on it, and slowly but surely I diminish the grasp of this food addiction on my life. But transformation makes the shift from the what to the who, which means that the law of transformation is that the way you perceive yourself, how you perceive, who you perceive yourself to be, will eventually determine the content of your consciousness. So why not go to the roots? Why not alter the sense of the very identity, and thereby creating a certain ripple effect, influencing the content of our consciousness? So this is a very important thing, and this goes back to Socrates, for instance, who insisted on self-knowledge, know thyself. You see, you don't deal with things, but you first of all ask yourself, who am I? Of course, Socrates meant it in a rather limited way, not as the, let's say, Indian rishis talked about. So this is the most important point: who, not what. Then there is the second point. May I continue, or perhaps I don't want to start lecturing?
No, go for it. Yeah, you just go wax lyrical. Go where you need to. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Because I think that there are three fundamental points. The second is a very profound point, and that is the point of alchemy, because transformation indicates that something, again, transforms its nature. So alchemy is the transformation, the alleged transformation of cheap metal into gold. But what we hear in transformation is that everything in our life is materials for transformation, which means everything, every cheap metal, every base emotion, every limited thought can actually be transformed, thus revealing its nature of light or Buddha or limitlessness. So we can start with everything. This is also a sort of tantric approach. And I always talk about tantra essentially as something that is different from all those spiritual methods that speak only about detachment, neutrality. You just look at something, you detach yourself, and you don't touch it. You don't get in touch with it. You just want to transcend. So tantra digs into the materials of our anger, and vengefulness and sexuality and desire, our base humanity, treating it as materials for golden transformation. So this is another meaning of transformation. And the third point of transformation is the way the limitless, your limitless nature, can affect your limited reality. That's another thing, because I don't want to overquote Einstein, because I know that everyone overquotes Einstein, but well, it was it was an awesome provider of quotes, I would say. And he used to say something that I love so much. Of course, I'm probably exploiting it, taking advantage of this quote unfairly. But he said, we can't solve our problems with the same level of thinking or with the same thinking we used when we created them. Now, that's a genius sentence in terms of expansion of consciousness, because it basically tells you, if you want to work on certain patterns, our very patterns, psychological patterns, were formed exactly on the basis of our limited thinking, limited conception of ourselves, limited conditioning, memory, knowledge, and so on. Therefore, we cannot work on them by simply operating on the very same level, the very same plane of consciousness. And this is what we try to do, right? In ordinary psychology, ordinary, ordinary conscious coaching, is that we simply replace one thought pattern, one belief, let's say, with another one. But it's replacing one thought with another, or one emotion with another. So, but what transformation tells us, no, take a leap to that higher state of consciousness, where you experience yourself boundless, free, and essentially unaffected by thought and by past impressions. And then from there, direct this kind of freedom, this kind of limitlessness, to that limited realm of your existence, and begin to modify, to rearrange it. So that's the third aspect of transformation. And of course, we can talk about many others, but these are the most fundamental. Work from the limitless, use materials, the materials of your base existence as human, for golden transformation, and of course, focus determinedly on the who, not the what.
Yeah, I feel really excited hearing you share all this, because of how resonant it feels with what I care about and what I really see emerging in the field of coaching as well. This approach of using everything that arises in daily life as the material for transformation, mm-hmm. the tantric approach is so suitable for Westerners in particular, and actually feels so resonant with our times because of how, like I call it a sutric approach, but that renuncia approach, actually affords a kind of transcendence from human experience, which, mm-hmm. Or a negating of the world, you know. So, in particular, I'd love to pick up what you were saying about, well, in a sense, we're going to weave these three together, I think, in our exploration. How do you therefore train or invite people to begin to make these kinds of shift or work in this way? I know you apply this to meditation, to healing, psychological work, trauma. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering if you could explain like the ways you work with people or the ways the shifts you invite them into so they can be this way with their experience. Yeah.
Yes, of course, of course. Well, that's actually a beautiful point that you're making, because I don't know if you've heard of the tantric teacher Lama Yeshe. He was a tantric Buddhist, and he was very influential in the 20th century. And he said that he believed that tantra. And again, we should distinguish tantra, the essence of tantra from traditional tantra, that this is the spirituality of the 21st century, that this is the spirituality that will eventually prevail, because I think it merges these two types of spirit, the Western spirit, which is very interested in the objective world, and the so-called, of course, generally construed, Eastern spirit that is very interested in the subject as consciousness. So combining the two, we get this kind of tantric approach. And it should be noted already now that I admire the renunciate approach. For me, some of my most admired figures in life have been utter renunciates and promoters of perfect detachment. But I think that for us in the West and in the 21st century, to just be focused to try to focus on this project of detaching our consciousness from life and observing it from afar with complete neutrality sounds very strange, because if you really want to follow this kind of approach through, you really need to end up somewhere in a cave or in the Himalayas. As long as you are positioning yourself in the midst of this kind of bustling Western lifestyle, as you somehow need to draw from the tantric well. So that's an important point. Now, because I am tantric at heart, what I do is that I have my teachings, of course, my purely mystical teachings. In these purely mystical teachings, I don't bother to direct the light of consciousness toward any actual dimensions of life. This is when we have to be purely abstract, and we have to actually allow our consciousness to become untethered from earthly bondage altogether. And we have to do that, because if we keep worrying what might happen and how this is related to human life and to actual life, this is a question that many ask me while we engage in this type of teaching. You see, we immediately worry, but how is this related to my daily life? But that's a very Western approach. First, you have to inaugurate this kind of immense unconditional encounter with your consciousness without any kind of limit or questions about the future. You have to jump into it. You have to jump into the ocean without questions. But the main focus of my teaching is how to take this light of consciousness and to direct it as if you used a torch to illuminate and dispel the darkness and transform each dimension of life. So what I've done throughout the many decades of my teaching has been to continuously or to focus on certain aspects of human life. For me, I divide the human experience into seven centers of experience and perception. We might delve into that a little at a certain point, because this has something to do with the ancient chakra system, but it's a development of the chakra system. But then it's how to make everything in our life illuminated, or and also a tool for transcendence.
Yeah. So before we explore that, you said like you and your teaching has been about, in a way, entering that mystical realm, or you know, like, these are my words, so yeah, use your words. But and then, you know, a common trap is people want to know, how is this going to be practical? What is that realm you're speaking about, that mystical realm? Are you talking here about you know, Buddha nature, awake awareness, consciousness, you know, the void, like, or something that's more full and full of information, you know, more subtle? I think you get my question. Yeah.
Well, I would say it is generally the dissolution of the sense of separation. Because usually we talk about this kind of mystical revelation in positive terms, and I think that leaves a lot of room for interpretation. Because you know, the Buddhist, or at least some of the Buddhists, would say that's a shunyata, that's emptiness, that's the nature of reality. The Hindus will come and say that's the realization of Atman, the self that is omnipresent. And each one has their names and their titles and their metaphysics. But I speak about the ending of a certain illusion. And I think perhaps we're going to talk about this kind of explosion of interest in our culture in the project of the self. You see, everyone is talking all the time about the self, self-improvement, self-fulfillment, self-expression, self-development, and it's always it's as if the self has become the new center of the universe, and we are surprised to realize that by pursuing this kind of project, happiness forever eludes us. So we keep trying to enhance that self and to make it more fulfilled, improved and developed and whatever. But then we end up experiencing ourselves in a state of isolation, depression, intense self-talk and so on. So the problem is that we have a certain illusion that needs to be wiped away. And the illusion is that life is my own. This life is my own. And I like to imagine ourselves as leaves in the cosmic tree. A leaf derives its power, derives its energy, its nourishment from the tree. It actually it is so, but we pretend as if we were leaves, a leaf standing out or separating itself all of a sudden from the cosmic tree, announcing, "This is my existence. I am a leaf unto myself," and so on. Mm-hmm. And when we begin to immerse ourselves in this kind of illusion, this is when we begin to get lost. So this is what I would say. That's the mystical realization. And when you look at the simplest phenomena of life, which is breathing, you will have to acknowledge that you are not breathing by yourself. We are not the breathers. So if we don't even govern or order this kind of very basic function, this means that something keeps breathing us into existence. And if we don't have this humbleness, the authentic humbleness of the realization of no self, I think the most important part of life is overlooked.
I see how spiritual paths are co-opted by that sense of self-development, you know, like I'm practicing to enlighten myself, you know. So even, you know, it can be very kind of insidious. And but my question is, Because for a lot of people, it might sound unappealing, you know, like my life isn't my own. So what it, you know, am I at the whim of, you know, I don't know, like the forces of life. And so and even like, is there some, so, and maybe it's not even enjoyable. So my question is more like, what's to be gained by opening that dissolution of the self and opening to how my life is not my own? What for you comes possible from that place?
Yes, that's an important question, because of course for Western ears and this although we must admit that this exists also in Christian mysticism, Jewish mysticism. It's not that it's in the Muslim mysticism, so it's not foreign to Western culture. We have it ingrained in our mystical schools. Well, first of all, we have to realize also to acknowledge the amount of anxiety that we experience as a result of thinking that our life is our own, and that we can somehow manage this life through our very limited mind that can perceive, that can capture so little. Really, if we begin to acknowledge to take a look around, we realize that we are bathing in an ocean of not knowing, and then somehow our small minds they govern some kind of a very tiny island of knowing and control. But since we keep deluding ourselves that we do have a perfect control, we live in a state of complete anxiety. And this kind of anxiety, this kind of worry, this kind of feeling of doership, I think this is what is what comes to an end. It's not that you don't do anything anymore, but it means that you co-create with something that is much greater than you. So this is exactly when you begin to have this kind of you begin to operate from this ocean, not as the drop. You are empowered by the ocean, by its intelligence, by its consciousness, by its creative forces, and even love and compassion that this ocean is naturally endowed with.
And do you feel that there's a place for then a sense of healthy power and individuation, you know, so that if for someone to really shift and you know, to non-doership, you know, actually a healthy sense of individuated self supports that. And then with that, a sense of unique, like my unique embodied contribution in this lifetime too, you know, like I find that, I don't know if that's like another delusion that makes me feel, you know, a little bit more satiated and like, oh, I do have a, you know, some use. And but no, you know, actually no, there is a sense of like when I look around the world, at people who I consider quite awake, they're all quite different as well, and there's something quite unique shining through them. And so, yeah, I'm just wondering about those two qualities.
Yes, that's an enormously important question. Well, first of all, I usually distinguish between two different forces, and these two forces they have operated since the very beginning of creation. The first is individualization. Individualization is actually much more metaphysical than what you and I do in terms of our self-fulfillment. It's the very wish, aspiration of every form in the universe to create, to define its borders, and to become seemingly independent, you see? Seemingly separate. And I think that this is a very essential need. We have this need for individualization. We actually experience it also in relationships, right? Because in relationships, we have on the one hand the wish for individualization. We sometimes want to be alone and separate and defined, self-defined, and to have our own journeys. But then we also experience the second force, and that is the force of unification. I think in our culture, the force of unification has nearly been eliminated, perhaps reduced to football teams and their nationalities and the and family units and sex. But the urge for unification is actually as just as important, and it maintains that just as all these forms aspire to define themselves and to experience themselves, they also aspire to lose their boundaries and to return to a certain original unity, which is a tremendous source of comfort and healing, because healing is also something to do with wholeness. You heal by becoming whole again. You see, so when we understand that, we understand that it is important to give room for this kind of force, the force of unification, in order to be complete. But in the very same way, we also have to fulfill our wish for individualization. This wish for individualization is just as divine, but we need to be very refined about it. And here, you see, because everyone wants to be special. And the wish to be special means to exaggerate our wish for individualization. I want so much to fulfill that need that I'm beginning to isolate myself and to center on myself. But if I replace special with unique, then that becomes completely beautiful and meaningful. Because unique means that you have a certain role to play in the vast tapestry of existence. And now this doesn't contradict our wish for unification. It actually complements it. It balances it. It's a part of it, because then just like every small flower plays its role in this kind of magnificent universal jigsaw puzzle, so too are you needed as this kind of missing piece. Without you, nothing would make sense in a way. So we have to be unique, and we have to have unique voices. We are not supposed to simply dissolve our individualities into some kind of undifferentiating wholeness.
Yeah.
You see?
Could you talk about the relationship between those? Do you feel that as one wakes up and releases that separate self, that and that sense of non-doership arises, and you know, we're going to get to this question too about the role of expanded states in healing and transformation. But so as one opens, you know, into that mystical place and experiences themselves as that, does that then afford almost like a spontaneous expression of uniqueness, you know, in a way that earlier was being kind of co-opted by that separate sense of self, you know, and that needed to maybe defend itself or make itself special in order to feel like it's covering up some sense of lack or something. So yeah, and in a sense, the question is about the relationship, because it seems kind of paradoxical, that relationship between non-doership and uniqueness.
Yes. Well, uniqueness is something that we cannot really suppress, because it is or do away with, because it is inherent. You see, we don't have a choice. We are unique. We are unique. So the only thing that we need to do in order to expose and realize this kind of uniqueness is by simply eliminating all the forces that hinder that. So but one of the elements that immensely hinder this kind of expression of uniqueness, not specialness, uniqueness, is a self-consciousness, which means, for instance, if we meet now and we have this kind of conversation, is you self-consciousness implies that while speaking, I constantly reflect on myself as a separate entity, thinking, how am I doing? What is he thinking about me? Standing out? Am I special? And also the self-criticism that comes with it, right? Because that's the nemesis of that is ingrained in self-consciousness. Because then this kind of positive self-talk also includes negative self-talk. Self-talk is self-talk. So this kind of thing. We think that this kind of self-image, cultivating this self-image, somehow has anything to do with our uniqueness. But uniqueness is when you unravel all these kinds of entanglements of self-consciousness, and then your radiance is simply there. You see, it's as radiant and as any flower. Is radiant, and we sometimes think, but if I remove that self-consciousness, immediately I remove my uniqueness, and we don't understand. We don't need to worry about that. We also don't need to worry about the dissolution of our creative forces and our so-called ambitious powers, because if you take a look at the forces of nature, they certainly don't have a self. Right? Lightning or clouds or mountains or flowers or magnificent trees or whales, they don't have a self. They don't need to have a self in order to be immense forces of nature that astound us. So sometimes people worry about that, and actually, unfortunately, as a mystical teacher, I worriedly watch people who, let's say, overindulge themselves in the mystical practices, and then they lose their natural ambition, natural drive, natural the force of nature in them.
And why is that? Yeah.
No, it's an important question. Why is that? And here I need to point out that there is, again, this kind of seven layers of our existence. You see, human beings, I think all of us, because we are so complex, we consist of seven layers, at least if we consider the chakra system. And this confuses us greatly. You see, because we have the meditator, and we have the thinker, and we have the manifestor, and the lover, and we have the warrior, and we have the enjoyer, and we have the builder, and all of these they seem to contradict each other and to pull each one each in their own direction, and then we think, I'm tired of all this complexity. Let's be simple. Which means not simple, but simplistic. Let's flatten my being, and only focus on one of these layers, or one or two, which I like, and discard all of the rest. And this is what many people do in the West when they over-focus on their warrior or their manifestor, neglecting the other parts, but also mystical people. They have the same, they're inflicted with the same tendency. And what they do is that they only focus on the meditator and suppress all other layers of their being, trying to be as simple as possible. Now, if the divine, if there is a divine, if this kind of cosmic intelligence wanted us to be so simple, it would have simply designed us without this kind of nagging complexity. But this nagging complexity, I believe, needs to be embraced and needs to be the true meaning of our spiritual practice.
I mean, fascinating to me. How can we do that, basically? How can we embrace that complexity?
Well, first of all, we need to learn about this kind of complexity and start acknowledging that we are complex beings, that we're not simple, and that's why actually we experience all the different inner voices in us. So, but the different inner voices, they seem contradictory only because we don't have this kind of orderly perception of ourselves. Complexity is not complication. It means it is actually the utter simplicity when you understand it and when you know how to navigate this kind of system. So that's the first thing. Now, the second thing is that, and this is a very interesting point, as soon as you activate your meditator, the seventh dimension, which is associated with the traditional crown chakra, immediately this complexity becomes even greater. Because all of a sudden, you introduce to your system a perception of yourself that is completely different from everything you know as a human being. Because now there is the dimension of limitlessness, timelessness, and then complete transcendence. There is the dimension of the spirit, and now it's awakening you. Now that's magnificent, but then we simply don't need to be addicted to it or to begin to settle there while trying to push down all the rest. So when we begin to have this kind of holistic vision, and we make sure that we learn how to activate each of these centers at the right time, without preventing each of the centers from interfering with the activity of the other centers. This is an art that I actually teach, and for me this is my greatest excitement, because I realized very soon in my life, in my spiritual life, that people always choose one dimension, while the human being is this kind of a strange hybrid of consciousness, spirit, limitlessness, and earthliness, that somehow also converge in what, in this kind of mysterious aspect, we call the human heart. In the human heart, everything makes sense, all this complexity, and we cannot intellectualize it, but we can somehow allow our hearts to be the intersection of all these forces.
Wow, there's so many questions I want to ask. I want to come back to the human heart, and I'm just getting a sense we have to do a part two. I'm just getting that strong feeling already. That's why I love doing this podcast, because I can just sort through my questions that come up. A question I have is, you know, in one sense, you just said part of our work with transformation is accessing our limitless nature. You know, earlier on when you named those three, yes, you know, the who, the alchemy, and the limitless nature. Yes. So that's part of it. But then I'm kind of hearing you say, in the right time, someone should work with these different centers and these different kind of, I don't know what to call them, like qualities or personalities, parts of us. But it sounds like it might not be the right thing for everyone to open the crown chakra, become a meditator. But actually, how is that different from accessing our limitless nature? That's the confusion I have in what you're saying. Is like Seems like that would be a good thing just to go there immediately.
Oh, I think the seventh dimension, the meditator, is something that we can tap into at any given moment. It's always available to us, and we ought to get in touch with it often. But the only point, and this is very important to understand, because the seventh dimension, sometimes we speak about the chakra system as if it were a ladder of development, as if you climb each step steadily, abandoning the previous step, and so on, until you abide in the supreme. But that's not really so. The chakra system is a simultaneous, multidimensional manifestation of the complexity of our being. So what is important to understand is just to know when to activate each. Let me give you an example. When I meditate, I certainly don't want to be in a state of doership, being busy with my ambitions. That's not the place, the time for with the warrior or the manifestor. I'm not supposed now to begin to think about my visions and about my schedule. And it's not even the time for to start thinking about my relationships, because that's the time as the meditator to leave the world behind. If I don't know how to leave the world behind, I would never be able to release or to acknowledge and to celebrate my limitless nature and as free spirit. Now, on the other hand, when I meet people, and this I hear, by the way, when people they come from retreats with me, spiritual retreats, and they immerse themselves in this kind of limitless nature, and then they meet people, and they try to remain in that state. Now, how do you even talk from that state? Because that would be ridiculous. You cannot communicate from that utterly empty and detached and transcendent state, because now you're encountering someone else, and you have to have some degree of individuality and some acknowledgement of the other's existence. And this is where my complexity begins to operate, because I need to learn how to move down from the crown chakra to the heart. We meet people here in the heart, not in the crown, because in the crown, it's an undifferentiated consciousness. You and I, we are just one mass of energy. And there is no Joel, there is no Shai. But here I can finally acknowledge and appreciate this, and allow this encounter through love, which is and love, I think, is this kind of binding element, that the only binding element that we should activate in our encounters, at least as the primal or the fundamental force.
I'm fascinated by this. Therefore, do you think, is it about aligning these different centers or qualities? Or because, I guess like I've been operating under the assumption and having experiences of, through meditation over many years, opening to dissolving a sense of separate self. That falling away, like a,
Yes.
ultimately findable separate self, still experiencing a sense of selfhood,
Exactly. Yes.
and therefore being in interactions with people from this sense of spacious, luminous knowing, and how that actually is also useful because, and I think this is where the tantric side comes in as well, but it's like, that kind of spaciousness and responsiveness that's come through that practice means that I can respond spontaneously. Maybe that's playfully, heartfully. Whereas when I was before the years of meditation and healing and all that, that they would be responding through a contracted kind of place. And that response is very different. So that's where I'm like, huh, interesting. So it seems like that crown chakra meditation work is still having an influence when I'm interacting with people. So I'm curious, like if it's aligning with the heart center, or if it's almost like a lever you pull where you can kind of switch on into what's most appropriate in which moment, you know, like the warrior in one moment is needed. And it's like you're learning, you're opening all those spaces so that you have full conscious access to those different modes of being. Like, yeah, I said a lot there, and I'll just.
No, you're actually responding to this so intuitively and so brilliantly. It's your description is very perceptive. Well, I would say exactly. First of all, the thing is with this kind of meditator perspective, it's that it's something that is supposed to ideally encompass all of our entire human experience. While we're talking right now, for instance, there is, of course, you know, this is a podcast and it's a serious podcast, and our conversation is very purposeful. We want to achieve something. So we certainly engage our warrior, our manifestor, and our thinker, right? And also our lover. Fortunately, it's not always like that in with podcasts, but fortunately here it is. So we activate all these, but if we allow ourselves also to have all these different layers active within this kind of energy field that is the energy field of the spirit, then what happens is that the meditator consciousness or perception imbues our meeting also with certain necessary qualities, for instance, non-attachment and this kind of relaxation or open listening that doesn't depend on results. You see, for instance, because we have this kind of openness that enables the encounter to be as it is, without doership. Perhaps we are loosening our sense of self-consciousness so as to enable this kind of shared space, this kind of space of unity. So the seventh dimension, the meditator, endows every experience, every human experience with this kind of light nature, this kind of Buddha nature that relieves it of this kind of desperate fundamental need for something to happen, and the ability to also rest our heads metaphorically in the timeless, not be so focused and so narrow in our grasp. So this is one. Now, if we begin to understand that, we'll think of our being as a layer within a layer, rather than it's almost like a different bodies that encompass or surround each smaller body. So then when you have this kind of vision, you will understand, of course, that it makes perfect sense that, for instance, you come out of meditation and you experience utter selflessness, but then you get in touch with someone and there is still some kind of selfhood active in you. Now, this confuses people because they immediately want to do away with this selfhood. Well, what does it do here? I want to be a complete non-doer. And some teachings, they try to do that. They say there is absolutely no doership in life. And then you challenge them and you ask, well, do you mean that if I now grab a knife and I murder you, would that also imply non-doership? And they will say, yes. So, but of course, that's already silly, plain silly. We don't want to be unreasonable. So the beautiful thing is that our design is extremely intelligent. We have selfhood. This selfhood is simply not who we are, but something that we have. It's a tool for expression. It's a tool for manifestation. We can say our personality is a tool rather than who we are. And the only confusion is that we try to make our personality who we are. And in this way, we associate our precious consciousness, our Buddha nature, with that personality and all the energy of awareness. This amazing energy is drawn into and sucked or processed by this kind of ego identification. That's the only problem. When we have this kind of vision, we understand, yes, we have these seven dimensions. Each of them has its own journey of fulfillment. Each of them has its own potential of expression. We shouldn't exaggerate or become obsessed with one of them or with two of them just because these are our inclinations or our personal tastes, because we have a certain obligation to realize the full human experience. While, of course, knowing when exactly and when each of them needs to be at the forefront and to lead.
Yeah. So yeah, what I really appreciate about this is the sense of how life-affirming this is, because I think I, in my path, had a period where I came across those sutric teachings, the renunciate teachings, combined with meditating and their approaches to meditation, which can actually be different than tantric ones. And, you know, I fell into nihilistic places, you know, where it felt like, yeah, life itself is just an illusion. And yeah, you know, like all these, everything that I experience about myself is just a kind of, you know, attachment and greed and aversion. And as I went on my path, and I started to open more, I started to experience this more just spontaneous, unique expression and an enjoyment of life, you know, like, so I'm really encouraged to hear about this and how each one of these seven kind of realms or flavors of life can be appropriate in a different moment. How do we know? You said this earlier in the conversation, like one of the things we need to learn about is to know where we might want to place our attention, like in each one of these different seven, you know, it might be one of them is needing attention from us. It's maybe underdeveloped, or how do you know where to go? And then what's the process once you get there and to help fill it out? Or again, this is all my words because I don't know how you'd speak about it, but to help develop that capacity. Yeah.
Yes. Well, first of all, one indication that I have two or more centers begin to fight over dominion, only because of my misunderstanding, because I still don't know my own system. So one indication is that I engage in a certain experience, and I experience a certain a contradiction, which means that something disrupts my ability to be fully in that experience. So that's the simplest indication. For instance, I make love, and then I have all kinds of thoughts, or I have all these kinds of feelings. I'm not able to fully make love, because now there is a certain different center of my perception experience and that thinks that it's also time to shine, you see. So for instance, when I dance, and I enter a sort of trance-like dance, then this is the time when my enjoyer, that's the second layer, my enjoyer is supposed to blossom. And this means that the thinker has nothing to do with this. The meditator can support it, but it cannot, we don't need to, we shouldn't allow it to diminish our enjoyment by starting to think about, all kinds of holy thoughts that make us turn off the feeling center, because this is the moment when we feel, we merge into feeling. Or we certainly, it's not the time for the manifestor, the warrior, I think it's quite obvious. The lover can, of course, can definitely inject some of its qualities into that moment. So it can act as a supporter. So when you experience a certain ability to a certain harmony in your experience, this means that the right center is active, fulfilling its potential. So when you feel this kind of disconcerting, this kind of troubling voice, then you need to identify where it comes from, and to basically tell it, well, that's not your turn. It's not your time to blossom.
And how would you differentiate that between, say, like I'm making love, and then I start to feel some of my early conditioning around my sexuality, insecurities, parts that show up, that feel some sense of lack, which they're not necessarily they're getting in the way, but they're not like one of these different qualities that you're naming. So is that part of the picture
they are,
too?
Actually. They are.
Okay,
they
yes,
are.
Yeah, go ahead.
What they are, this is the interesting part, because you see, as sexuality is a very good example, because we rarely know how to have a pure sexual experience that is unalloyed, that is uncontaminated by thinking. Now, thinking about sexuality is the result of the intervention of all sorts of different centers. For instance, the thinking center, because we're beginning to develop to use it as a source of self-consciousness, observing ourselves going through a certain experience, having all kinds of interpretation. Now, of course, these can originate in some kind of imprints, so all kinds of mental constructs that we've built. So what we will need to do is, of course, to return to these imprints, to work on that kind of, unbalanced thinking center that now introduces thoughts that reflect and that disturb my experience. And then I want to reach a state in which my experience can be without this kind of self-consciousness, without this kind of observing, judging, thought. So that is exactly the point. We have the judge, the critic comes from the thinking center. Yes.
So if I was to stay with that example or this context, something like trauma, which, isn't necessarily thinking, it's embodied kind of energetic, conditioning from experiences that were too intense for us. How would you relate that to these centers? Because it's not necessarily thinking trauma, it's a different thing. So,
first of all, in trauma, there are, of course, there is a form of thinking, but a form of unconscious thinking. This is what can be termed memory connections. It's irrational memory connections. Someone just told me yesterday about how she She ate a damaged tuna sandwich or something like that, and then she didn't touch a tuna for 25 years or something like that, because there is this kind of memory connection, this kind of thought forming. Tuna equals danger for eternity. So it just actually what happens is that we are in trauma that well, in a way, it depends on how severe the trauma is. In a way, all of our centers, they are shut down. We don't have their conscious activity there, so we turn off the feeling center, we turn off the emotional center, and we turn off the thinking center. And in a way, we bring everything to a state that is utterly unconscious, allowing automatic activity to take place in these centers. And then this is how we have these imprints, because later after this experience, when our centers begin to reoperate, we are realizing that there is something that is profoundly irrational that has taken root in these centers. Now, how do you take care of an absence of consciousness in a certain center? By imbuing it with consciousness. And that's why here is where consciousness is the greatest trauma healer.
Yeah. Yeah, this is the perfect setup for part two. So in a sense now, let's talk about that. You know, like how is consciousness the greatest healer? How can we open up these centers, or, you know, if just how can we begin to heal and awaken with the support of consciousness? What's that? What's the core of that process?
Well, let's give the actual example of trauma, because I think that makes it very vivid. You see, there are three. You can talk about three stages. First of all, there is the stage in which you need to revisit that memory, to zoom in on these moments or that period of time. Sometimes it's just a brief moment. Sometimes it's hours. Sometimes it's days or weeks and even months. So, but you need to zoom in on a certain moment in which you were experiencing the deepest state of unconsciousness, the deepest shock that robbed you of any sense of power, any sense of control, and begin to discern what took place there to bring it to the light. So you need to realize how you dissolved your presence, or you withdrew your presence, how you were not there, how you were experiencing yourself as complete victim, how you stopped breathing, how you with your resistance to the flow of emotionality, you simply shut down your feeling center, how you froze at that moment, and actually, because you froze, you gave rise to the formation of so many different irrational memory connections that are still alive in you. So all these, this is the first act of consciousness. You have to realize how unconscious you were and what took place while you were unconscious. You see? So that's the first stage. Then there is the stage of the expansion of consciousness, because at this point, if you ask a person to revisit their traumatic experience, that would certainly feel completely hopeless. They would cry. They would feel this kind of humiliation and powerlessness and lack of energy and despair. And now you have the choice. Do you try to correct trauma using a certain compensatory mental tools or mental or emotional tools, or do you are you going to heal it radically, at the core, to the root of the trauma? So then you move to the expansion of consciousness. In this, the expansion of consciousness, you actually allow, and perhaps we'll talk about it in a different conversation, because we have to be very accurate about it and to explain what that actually means. You begin to experience the broadening of your awareness of the part of your awareness, how your awareness that in the traumatic experience was actually just a tiny bit stuck in this kind of ocean of suffering and disorientation. Now this seed begins to germinate and to blossom, and you begin to experience your presence again, exactly the presence you lost, and you begin to experience yourself bigger than your body, bigger than the memory, bigger than your victimizer, if there was one. You are so big that now you are able to finally return to that memory and pour your newfound sense of presence into that memory. Because that's the magical thing, the magical key. If you agree to return to that memory and to say, I know it sounds strange, say yes to the experience. Not by thinking that it's a wonderful experience, not at all, but by saying, yes, I agree to be there, to breathe, and to unfreeze myself and to allow the flow of life to take place, then the trauma can begin to heal itself. But you cannot do it unless you really feel bigger than the memory, you see? You would never be able to say yes to something that you feel smaller, too small to contain. So you have to have this kind of confidence that you are a free, unlimited, joyful, unaffected by time and memory being to be able to say that yes.
And this is what we're going to go into in our second part of our conversation, because we have to round up now. Why I'm so thrilled about this is because I see this kind of principle emerging in different places when I think about something like internal family systems, where they talk about shifting to the self with a capital S, you know, presence, to be with parts, or Thomas Hubel's work. It's really about... Yeah, you know what you said at the beginning with Einstein, you can't heal something from the same place. Like, if you're bigger than it, there's a sense of appreciation and love that can pour into that frozen part or aspect that is incredibly healing. And my sense is, not knowing, you know, you've just touched into it, but you have a very something unique to contribute to this evolving edge through what you're saying. So if you're willing, we'll talk about then a part two. And I just want to say thank you, Shai. This has been a brilliant conversation. And where can we find out more about your work as well?
Well, I always invite listeners to two channels. First of all, there's my official website, which is, well, shaitubali.com. And there you can find everything about upcoming events, blog articles, and information, general information. And then there is my YouTube channel, which is filled with videos on the expansion of consciousness, guided meditations, how to integrate spiritual realization into daily life. So there are so many videos there that you can simply get to know a great deal of my work there through that.
Brilliant. Yeah, thanks, Shai.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training, The Neuroscience of Change. This program reveals the biology of change, showing us what happens in the brain and the body when different coaching techniques are used. You'll learn how to work with the innate pathways of change in all of us, so you can create powerful transformation with your clients. Just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by February the 7th. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.